Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Facebook under fire again. At issue, data breaches, the spread of misinformation and hate speech may be tipping the balance of elections and threatening democracy. Yesterday in London, officials from nine countries wanted answers from a Facebook vice president. He was there, but CEO Mark Zuckerberg was not.
We don't know that Mr. Zuckerberg's looking into this because he has refused to show up to speak to parliamentarians from around the world. I put it to you that you have lost the trust of the international community to self-police.
From the Cambridge Analytica data mining scandal to a New York Times investigation about what the company knew about Russian election interference, Facebook is in damage control mode, the world demanding that it fulfill its promise to fix itself. This hour on Point, taming the social network giant. Join us. What do you make of the growing number of crises surrounding the social media giant? Are you done with Facebook? Is it time to get serious about regulating Facebook? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from London, England, is Alex Hearn. He's the technology reporter for The Guardian. He covered yesterday's hearing in London, where leaders from nine countries questioned Facebook Vice President Richard Allen. You can link to his reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Alex Hearn, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us who was in London and what they wanted to know from Facebook.
So in London, there were representatives from a dizzying array of countries, as well as members of the House of Commons Department for Culture, Media, Select and Digital Select Committee, led by Damian Collins, MP. There was a representative from Argentina, a representative from Brazil, three from Canada, two from Ireland, one from Latvia, three from Singapore, one from Belgium and one from France.
Right.
All sat round to basically shout at whoever Facebook sent.
Okay, we're going to talk about that. But it's important to note here just how many Facebook users are represented by these nine countries, right? I mean, we think of Facebook as an American company, but obviously it has a huge global reach.
Yeah, exactly. Particularly once Brazil signed on board, this committee began to represent hundreds of millions of people and hundreds of millions of Facebook users. By the end, the count was something like a combined population of around 450 million, so you know, significantly larger than the population of the United States. And yet, yeah, Facebook didn't send Mark Zuckerberg to hear the committee's questions.
Right. And that was a concern, wasn't it? I mean, talk a little bit about that, the fact that Mark Zuckerberg wasn't there.
It was, if I'm honest, it was the overarching theme of the entire session. Each time Richard Allen, the European policy chief who Facebook did send, each time he said he couldn't answer a question, he didn't have the detail to answer the question, he wasn't present when a particular decision was made, the parliamentarians sat around the committee, had, you know, yet another reason to go, well, you should have sent Mark Zuckerberg. On top of that, it is, you know, Facebook has made this problem for itself. Every single time it's had any further catastrophe over the past year, the response has inevitably been that Mark Zuckerberg has stood up and said, the buck stops with me. I take responsibility for everything that happens in Facebook. So those two messages are combined to mean that essentially the only person who takes responsibility is Mark Zuckerberg. Mark Zuckerberg won't come and talk to the combined representatives of nine countries. So how can they hold anyone responsible if the only person who Facebook will allow to say is responsible stays in America?
Yeah, interesting point. Well, let's listen to a little tape from yesterday. Here's a British Member of Parliament, Ian Lucas, who tore into Facebook Vice President Richard Allen for how the company deals with the misuse of personal data by third parties. He mentions the app GSR, which gathered data in the Cambridge Analytica scandal. Let's listen.
Facebook have told us again and again a tissue of lies about the way your company operates.
And I'll contest that, again, to be very clear.
Give me one example of a business that you have banned because they've shared information.
Beyond GSR.
Beyond GSR.
I will come back to you. I don't want to mention the name of a business that then turns out to be inaccurate. I will come back to you.
Wow. So, Alex, it sounds like the questioning got pretty intense and pretty aggressive yesterday.
Yeah, it did. There were a lot of very angry MPs there. Some of the harshest questioning came not only from Britain's DCMS Select Committee, but also from the Canadian representatives, who were angry both because Zuckerberg had refused their own request to give evidence in the Canadian Parliament, and because Canada has been drawn into this through the involvement of a company called Aggregate IQ in the Cambridge Analytica scandal. It was a tangential player, but one which was housed in Canada and had its own questions over data misuse played up there. More generally, there was another piece of tinder lit below the fire of the committee, which was a selection of emails seized by the committee on Sunday, just days before this hearing began. The exact situation behind this is still a bit murky, but essentially what's happened is an American company which is suing Facebook, called 643, obtained some internal Facebook communications as part of the discovery process in their California lawsuit. Those communications were sealed by the California court, so they could not be reported or shared. But the founder of 643 had come to Britain, where Damian Collins, the chair of the UK parliamentary committee, issued a summons, sent the sergeant at arms, who is the state official responsible for enforcing parliamentary rules, sent the sergeant at arms to this man's hotel room and escorted him to Parliament, where the committee then seized his laptop and obtained this communication. The DCMS committee hasn't yet released the full details of the communication. So all we know really is what they quoted in this committee, where they accused Facebook, among other things, of having discovered but never reported on a Russian IP address which connected to the site and downloaded some 3 billion records.
Mm. So what is Facebook saying about this? Or are they saying anything?
They're saying quite a lot through the persona of Richard Allen, this policy chief who sat in front of the committee and gamely answered their questions for a good few hours. The problem that Allen has, of course, is that he is a mid-ranking executive at Facebook. He reports now to Nick Clegg, who ironically actually was his former boss as well. They're both Liberal Democrat politicians in the UK. But Nick Clegg is now Facebook's incoming communications chief. Clegg then reports to Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg. So, this is two steps removed from really the room where it happens. And yet he was there trying to answer their questions.
So I want to play a little more tape from yesterday. This is Canadian MP Charlie Angus, who suggested introducing antitrust regulation to contain essentially Facebook at the hearing in London yesterday. So here's how Facebook Vice President for Policy Solutions Richard Allen responded to that suggestion.
Unless you're going to turn off the internet, I am not confident that the people we serve, you serve, would be better off in a world where Facebook is not able, however imperfectly, to offer services where we spend 15 years learning how to do it.
So that was Facebook Vice President Richard Allen. Alex Hearn, were the folks, the delegates here, the parliamentarians who were questioning Allen, more or less unified in their concerns about Facebook, or did they bring separate agendas?
I think they were. It was actually one of the most interesting things watching the whole affair, where often these committees, particularly something as multinational as this, can be quite full of grandstanding on the part of the representatives. Here, I did get the sense of a real unity of purpose, a unity of anger, really. Anger that Mark Zuckerberg had stood them up, in the words of the Canadian representatives, had blown them off. Anger that Facebook had still, a year on from the Cambridge Analytica scandal breaking, 2 years on from the US general election, still not, to their eyes, fully answered all of the questions that were raised by those issues, and certainly not fully fixed the problems. Facebook runs a war room for the US midterms and the Brazil elections, which then it was reported this week disbanded after. It said that, essentially its work there was done. Well, that feels like a hostage to fortune for the next major election, when you can pretty you can be pretty certain that there will be yet more issues regarding that intersection between Facebook, democracy, and the media.
Yeah, big questions. Alex Hearn, stand by. I want to introduce another guest who's with me in the studio. But first, I want to say we did reach out to Facebook and request that a senior Facebook official, including Sheryl Sandberg, join this show. They declined to join the show. We didn't hear back from them. I'd like to introduce Dipayan Ghosh. She's a former privacy and public policy advisor at Facebook. He served there from 2015 to 2017. He was a technology policy advisor at the White House during the Obama administration. He's now a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Shorenstein Center. Dipayan Ghosh, good to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
I'd love to just get your quick reaction about what you've heard from Alex Hearn and the goings-ons in London yesterday.
Well, I think Alex's accurate reporting on the events of this week are really just an illustration of the fact that this is an industry that is that absolutely needs to change. The business model that operates silently underneath companies like Facebook, as well as other social media companies like YouTube and Twitter and Snapchat, is very clear. It's premised on very compelling services and apps that, as Richard Allen says, these companies create over 15 years, but which are stifling competition in the market, alongside the uninhibited collection of data and the opaque creation of algorithms that target content at us and target ads at us. And that is that's the commercial regime that is responsible for the spread of disinformation and hate speech.
So the commercial interest, you're saying, essentially is front and center and perhaps overwhelms the public interest, maybe.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think that for Facebook or any other internet company in Silicon Valley, that does not distinguish them from any other company, that they are interested in their commercial interests over the public interest. I think that when we reach certain points where certain industries become so powerful, we need to change the way that they work through regulation.
All right. And we're going to talk about that in the next break. Listeners, we are discussing the world leaders taking Facebook to account on fake news, election influence, and data privacy. You can join the conversation. Do you trust Facebook with your personal information? How about the information you find on your news feed? Is it time for regulation? As Dipayan Ghosh was just talking about, we're going to talk about that after the break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about Facebook, the promise and challenge of this huge social media platform and how to fix it and how to regulate it. Here's CEO Mark Zuckerberg, who pushed back on the media coverage of Facebook in an interview with CNN's Lori Siegel last Tuesday.
There are always going to be issues. If you're serving a community of more than 2 billion people, there's going to be someone who is posting something that is problematic, that gets through the systems that we have in place, no matter how advanced the systems are. And I think, by and large, a lot of the criticism around the biggest issues has been fair. But I do think that if we're going to be real, there is this bigger picture as well, which is that we have a different worldview than some of the folks who are covering this.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg there. You can join the conversation. Has Facebook been a force for good in your community? Are you concerned about data breaches, a threat to privacy? Do you think Facebook and companies like it need federal regulation? What might they look like? I'm speaking with Alex Hearn, technology reporter at The Guardian, and Dipayan Ghosh, former privacy and public policy advisor at Facebook. And Dipayan, I'd love to come back to you because we were beginning to talk about the need for regulation. And I know this is a big question and we'll get into it deeply in the rest of the hour, but How do we begin to think about that? What might that regulation look like?
Well, let's start with what we just heard Mark Zuckerberg say, which is that the platform is so big. It has over 2 billion users, and that there is always something that is going to happen. And I'd like to challenge that and just say that, yes, this is a huge platform, but think about what he's saying. What he's saying here is that you cannot build, as Facebook, you cannot build algorithms or artificial intelligence that can effectively suppress hate speech or effectively suppress disinformation operations because there's so much of it. Similarly, you cannot protect yourself against security threats or privacy breaches. I would challenge that because if you look at the way that the biggest internet companies in Silicon Valley spend their money, it is to develop the algorithms and collect the data that empower their system and have taken over the consumer internet. If we were to ask them to just divert 5% of the investment that they put in that toward this problem that could solve the public the problems in the public that we're facing today, we would resolve this. And the fact that the industry does not voluntarily do that today suggests that it never will, until and unless the public sentiment is big enough to encourage it or push it to do that. And where we have to start is by looking at that business model and tackling privacy, transparency, and competition in the market.
So these are three really important principles that that you've talked about, and I want to get to those. But let me go back to Alex Hearn in London, and Alex, ask you, in terms of the conversation around regulation, what are they saying in Europe? Or did that come up yesterday?
Not in any great detail, which I think is fairly common for conversations around regulating Facebook. In fact, the attendee who went into the most detail was one of the Canadian representatives who suggested that Facebook should either be regulated as a public utility or broken up. In general, the discussion in Europe around how to regulate Facebook has been looking at how to force Facebook's internal processes to be accountable to the wider democratic system. So that would involve, for instance, not requiring Facebook to take down particular posts or particular content, not sort of putting police in Facebook's offices, but just mandating that Facebook's complaints and appeals process actually works and holding it liable when that doesn't. It's quite a boring nuts and bolts effort, but in terms of something that would actually pass relatively soon in legislative time, that's the sort of thing that we'll see coming in the short term, I think.
Let's take some calls. We've got a lot of listeners already standing by who want to get on this conversation and have some questions about Facebook, about what to do, about whether it's a force for good, how to regulate it. We're talking about all that this hour. Let's go to Jesse, who's calling from Grosse Pointe Woods, Michigan. Jesse, thanks for the call. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am admittedly oblivious about the cost and difficulty of algorithm building, although I'm sure that is a necessary portion of this problem. But I think that part of the solution really is self-policing on the part of Facebook users and the age-old responsibility of doing due diligence before you just start spreading rumors.
Jesse, it's a good point. I'm glad you brought it up, Dipay and Ghosh. I mean, I want to get in deeper into your sort of principles of transparency, privacy, and competition around regulation. But what about Jesse's idea that this really begins with the responsibility of the user?
I absolutely agree. The issue that I see is just that it is always very hard to engage in public education efforts. How do we enforce that? Should it be the government that tells the public what social media is all about? Or should the government compel Facebook to put at the top of the news feed some information about how the news feed works? And even if it does those things, will those things be effective in moving the average user? And remember, we are talking about users not just in the United States, but around the world, India, Australia, Taiwan, etc. I do think that there is a point here in self-policing. The reason I think it is hard for the industry to do it is because it's just not in their interest to do it. and their interests are conflated. So instead, what they have been trying to do is develop recommendations from the outside, from whether it's from governments or from nonprofit third parties that are respected by the public, to tell them where the right line is on hate speech or on disinformation, so that they can just enforce that and not be responsible for setting that line. That might be the right way forward, at least in some respects.
Let's take another call. Paul is calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Paul, you're on the air. Thanks so much for the call.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead, Paul. What's your question?
Facebook. I had one. Well, I believe that it's the antisocial network. The fact is that people don't actually want to interact with one another. They just want to interact with their computers or their phones. And most people, they don't know how to interact with one another.
So, Paul, what's your experience? Are you on Facebook? Do you work on Facebook? Tell us a little bit about your experience.
I was on Facebook. I had one friend. It was 2009, probably. And then all my friends said I need to get on Facebook, and it was 2010. I reconnected with all of my friends from the time I was in a baby carriage till the time I was up until, what was that? I was 39, almost 40. And then I found that it was a time sucker. It was a life sucker. That you were living a life that you weren't really living through the computer and spending too much time on it. And people weren't really wanting to reach out. They just wanted to be able to do something easy and click and done and watch it all roll in. Now people are trained. They're like Pavlov dogs. The best thing people can do is turn off all the notifications on their phones.
All right, Paul, I got it. There's Paul who's sort of had it with Facebook and makes a good case why that is. DePine, I want to come back to you and sort of talk about sort of the look of what regulation might look like. You've written about something called a digital social contract, and you made mention of these three principles earlier in the hour: transparency, privacy, and competition. So, how would a set of government regulations — well, first, just explain what that is, a digital social contract.
Yeah, this is the idea that the industry has really gained a lot of power.
Yeah.
And it has gained power because of technology. Technology that has allowed anyone who's able to pay for it and buy it up excel in computing and data analysis. And those technological trends have led to the rise of the Silicon Valley internet giants, Facebook, Google, and et cetera. They are absolutely controlling an industry right now, which has subverted the public interest in certain ways. And at the same time also subjugates consumers. This is the idea that as the industry rises, the consumer's interests are subverted by the commercial interests pursued by the industry. And what my co-author Ben Scott and I argue is very much in line with what our caller Paul just said. What we argue is that we need to think anew about this whole situation, think about developing a digital social contract, the idea that we reconsider and reevaluate the distribution of power between the consumer, the government, and the industry, particularly Silicon Valley. Right now, it's very weighted toward Silicon Valley, and we need to redistribute that weight through a combination of regulatory policies addressing transparency, privacy, and competition in the market, because those are the three areas that would respond to the business model that sits behind Facebook and Google and
okay,
others.
So for example, would that mean regulation that would essentially require, for example, Facebook to be transparent about a particular news feed, where it comes from, who's behind it, to basically give you the option or a more robust option to opt out of sharing your data or at least to be aware of it? I mean, are those the kinds of things we're talking about?
Absolutely. Privacy. Is really it's not necessarily about telling a company or a set of companies what data they can or cannot collect. It's really about the individual. It's about giving the individual absolute autonomy and control over their information. Transparency is absolutely about giving the individual a view, a perspective into the ways that their information is being collected and utilized.
Is the idea that it would be incumbent on the company essentially to sort of come to me and say, Anthony, you're on Facebook and we're really interested in using your data because we want to sell advertising and give it to a whole bunch of people that you don't know anything about. Is that okay with you? I mean, is that sort of what is that the as opposed to they're taking my data and if I'm attentive enough and smart enough, I'm going to be aware of that and I'll try to take steps to block it.
Yeah, I mean, there is no doubt that transparency is not going to cure everything. That's why we also call for privacy and competition as part of this. Public education and more incisive journalism are also aspects that we need to consider. But just to give one example of where transparency is lacking in this industry, if we compare the internet and Facebook advertising or Google advertising or Twitter advertising to broadcast advertising in the political context. Right now, if Bernie Sanders puts a political ad up on television, he's compelled to say at the end of it, and this ad was sponsored, or I endorse this ad as Bernie Sanders, and that is a federal requirement.
Right.
He's required to do that by law. And when you're watching broadcast television, you know that that ad is being seen by a certain number of people, and you know that it's publicly out there and it's going to be available later on. You don't know any of that in digital advertising. In the digital world, if you see an ad on Facebook, you cannot track it. You know very little about where it came from. In other words, you don't know the provenance. You don't know how much was paid for it. You don't know who else may have seen it.
DePine, I'm going to come back to you, but I want to go to Alex Hearn one more time because we have to let him go. Alex, is there serious talk in Europe around these issues of regulation, the kind of thing that DePine Ghosh is referring to?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, some of it is well beyond talk. So, for instance, in Europe, the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, came into effect earlier this year, and it effectively requires exactly what you were suggesting. Facebook has to come to users and say, hey, we want to use your personal data to advertise. The problem with that in practice, it turns out, is that what Facebook actually says to users is, If you don't want us to use your personal data to advertise, well, the door's over there. Please delete your account, otherwise we're afraid you'll have to give us this permission to continue. So naturally, most Facebook users gave the permission. Other individual European countries have enacted their own regulation with harsher teeth. So perhaps the biggest talking point in Europe right now is a German law which gives Facebook a 24-hour window to take down hate speech once it's been reported to it. And if it's not down at the end of those 24 hours, then the German state reserves the right to fine Facebook. That is, I think, a law that would be antithetical to most Americans, but it certainly chimes with Germany's long history of trying to keep hate speech out, which, of course, you know, dates back to the Second World War. And the thing that's really attracted European regulators' interest is the fact that, anecdotally, Facebook has invested an awful lot more money in its German moderation team as a result of this. It turns out if they're afraid of getting hit with swinging fines, they will invest some of this money that the DePine was saying, you know, they are typically loath to do. Wave a big stick in front of them and you can force an awful lot out of them.
Really interesting. Alex Hearn, technology reporter for The Guardian. We're going to let you go. Thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you for having
me. We really appreciate it. You can link to Alex's reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's try to fit in one more call before the break. Skyler is calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Go ahead, Skyler. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Anthony. I'm a computer science student and an entry-level web developer. And I guess the question I'd like to put to your expert, less in regard to the hate speech and more in regard to the data collection, wouldn't it make more sense for us to look at regulating the data collection industry as a whole rather than regulating the independent social networks that rely on that business model?
Interesting question. DePine Ghosh, what do you think?
Absolutely. I completely agree with Skyler that we need to think broadly about data collection and data use. And a privacy regulation would not necessarily have to be focused just on social media companies or just on big internet companies. It could absolutely go across the board to automobile manufacturers and hotel chains and internet companies and data brokers who are in the business of collecting information about us on the open web and through other means and selling it to the highest bidder. We have come into a world, we've come into a situation with the tremendous expanse of data and computing. It is a world in which the individual has lost any semblance of autonomy in the digital space.
Right. Are you, and we're coming up close to, so this is a, I'm going to save this question. What I was going to ask you, and I'm going to ask you this after the break, you know, do you still believe in the potential of this technology to be a democratic and liberating force, I guess, which I was going to ask you, but with 20 seconds to remaining, I think we need more time to answer that question. So listeners, you can join the conversation. Were you a fan of Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In or Mark Zuckerberg's rumored presidential run? Have your feelings changed given the scandals around data breaches, the spread of fake news and hate speech? Is it time to regulate Facebook? We're going to continue the conversation. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're taking a look at the problems facing Facebook and how to tame it, whether to regulate it, given a long line of crises and scandals around the company, around data breaches, the spread of hate speech, election influencing, to name just a few. So here's Facebook, a Facebook ad from April of this year, just a few weeks after CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified before Congress. The ad features images of friends connecting on the social media platform.
We found others just like us. And just like that, we felt a little less alone. But then something happened. We had to deal with spam, clickbait, fake news, and data misuse. That's going to change. From now on, Facebook will do more to keep you safe and protect your privacy, so we can all get back to what made Facebook good in the first place. Friends.
Listeners, what do you think? Do you have confidence that Facebook is doing more to protect your privacy so you can get back to connecting with your friends? I'm speaking with Dipayan Ghosh, a former privacy and public policy advisor at Facebook. He's now a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Shorenstein Center. And joining us now from San Francisco, California, is Shira Frankel. She's cybersecurity reporter for the New York Times, and you can link to her reporting at onpointradio.org, including a major investigation this month on what Facebook knew about Russia. Russian interference in the 2016 election and what they did and didn't do in response to it. Shira, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we've been talking, let me go back to sort of the top of the hour. We were talking about the conference in London focused on Facebook, and among the big concerns, CEO Mark Zuckerberg wasn't there. What's your reaction to that?
I think that his failure to appear now several times before the Europeans, especially in London, has been marked in that country. And I think that it's led to quite a backlash against him and more broadly Facebook. It's seen as sort of a lack of transparency at a time when the company is really pushing this idea that they're trying to be transparent.
Right. Your reporting on Facebook earlier this month, and we made reference to it, the major takeaway that Facebook knew about Russian interference in the 2016 election and failed to counter it. How has Facebook responded to this major investigation by the New York Times?
Well, the initial response was to not really say much of anything. I'll note that we spoke to Facebook for several weeks before the article came out. We gave them, you know, lots of information about what we were going to publish, and they chose not to really comment and not to make their executives available to us. After the story came out, quite a few days after, they started to comment, and I think their first response was to call our story inaccurate. But the things they pointed to as inaccurate were not things we said in our story. And they've since kind of backtracked bit by bit by bit until the very eve of Thanksgiving, when they finally came out with a statement admitting a lot of what was in our story. And the irony here is that the headline of our story talked about how Facebook's policy was to deny and deflect. And that's what they've done here. They've denied what was in our story initially, then they tried to deflect, and now they've eventually had to come around and acknowledge that our reporting was accurate.
DePayne, I'd love to ask you, as someone, you know, former privacy and public policy advisor at Facebook, this policy of deny and deflect, I mean, do you have a perspective on that from someone who was in the inside at one point?
Well, I think that it's no different from any other company in the Valley. There is a tremendous pressure on policy, on the policy team and other policy teams to try to understand the public sentiment and then craft communication strategy and policy strategy that can raise the company's interests you know, anyone working for the company is working for the company. In other words, working for the commercial interests of the company, and it's not their job to think about what's in the interests of the reader of the New York Times or the public.
Shira and DePayne, stand by. I want to go through at least a couple of calls here because we've got a bunch of them backed up. Let's go to Claire, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Claire, thanks so much for calling. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you. About the privacy issue, first of all, with power comes responsibility. And my data, your data, everybody's data is priceless to these companies.
Mm-hmm.
But we have no control over how they use it, if it gets hacked, if it gets abused, if it's incorrect. And just for those reasons, it seems to me there should be some kind of regulation at least as strong as what banks currently have.
Claire, I appreciate that call, and we're going to take that up. Let me go to Greg, who's calling from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Greg, you're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding the sort of unprecedented nature of the service of that Facebook provides, and the consequent lack of understanding of the business model from consumers or amongst consumers, and what role that sort of lack of informed consent might have in allowing for government regulation over the use of private data in sort of targeted malicious advertising.
Greg, it's a great question. DePayne Ghosh, I feel like that one is yours.
Yeah. I think Greg is absolutely spot on in his analysis. And in other words, not every user of Facebook or American citizen is going to be as well informed as Claire is about the extent of the business model and how these companies collect and use data. Yeah. To our earlier point, we need much better public education. We need much better transparency into what the sector is doing. We need to give consumers the right to have control and consent. And we need to start doing more things through the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission and Congress to bring about better competition in a sector that is dominated by three players now.
Shira, I want to ask you a little bit about the response from Facebook to the sort of current climate of crisis and inquiry, essentially. And I'm just going to read a quick paragraph from Politico. In the past few months, the social networking giant has shown greater readiness to address outrage. It hired Nick Clegg, a former deputy British Prime Minister, to be its new chief global policy wonk. It removed tens of thousands of fake accounts worldwide. It even joined forces with the French government in a 6-month project to revamp the country's hate speech rules. So that's by way of leading up to a question. I mean, is Facebook, do you get the sense that Facebook is taking all of these concerns seriously and trying to move seriously to address them?
I think they've been put in a position where they have to take these concerns seriously. In the lead up to the midterms, there was so much scrutiny on the company. It was a real test for them about whether or not they could prevent false news and foreign influence campaigns on the platform. And so they have hired over 10,000 people, I think, at this point. They've erected teams that didn't previously exist to look for disinformation, to watch for foreign influence campaigns. All those steps have been taken. But I will note that those steps were taken in a mad rush to the finish line. Most of them just began to be implemented in January, February. And Facebook said themselves that it's a bit of an arms race, and they don't know what their adversaries are going to do next. So is Facebook taking it seriously? Yes, we've seen steps put in place to try and find these kinds of influence campaigns, this kind of disinformation by foreign states that weren't there in the past. Mm. But there's a question of whether they are fundamentally built to deal with these problems and whether the people who are currently at the head of the company are the kinds of people who can look around corners, see what's coming next, and think the way an adversary would think, and not, you know, the people who built the company who perhaps still see it as this sort of fantastic way to connect the world and this happy-go-lucky, you know, Silicon Valley company. Are they pessimistic enough, maybe, to see the problems on their own platform and deal with them?
Interesting. I mean, one of the takeaways I got from your reporting is speaking of the people at the top, I mean, let's talk about Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, it seemed like one of the points that he was more or less making is that he didn't understand the issues early enough, which resulted in this sort of lack of transparency and these other issues. I mean, do you buy that? Did he really? And that he was sort of on the outside of some of the big decisions that were being made.
Right. So do I buy it? I mean, it's his opinion and it's how he views himself. So I'm not inside his head. But I will say that the way the company is structured sort of keeps Mark Zuckerberg outside of the realm of a lot of these decisions. Until very recently, he was very siloed on product teams and on new technology. And a lot of the policy stuff, a lot of the things we wrote about, such as, you know, the early findings of Russian interference, that fell under Sheryl Sandberg. Mm-hmm. So it might be that it just didn't make its way up the chain to him as quickly as it should have. But I will say that at some point in very early 2017, he was there. He had meetings. He was briefed on what they had found. He was told, hey, this is a huge problem. We know about the tip of the iceberg, and we know that the Russians have done more than we've currently found. And even then, he didn't choose to go public, and he didn't choose at that point to say, let's hire 10,000 people, let's put teams in place. It took quite a while for those kinds of changes to be made. So I guess I question again whether they took it seriously enough and whether they really thought that this was something that deserved the daily attention of the top executives of the company when it was first brought to their attention.
A couple more callers. Let's go to Jennifer, who's calling from Northampton, Massachusetts. Jennifer, you're on the air. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about privacy issues, and I have found that there are a bunch of things out there, a bunch of companies, nonprofit, that can help people block things on Facebook, as well as block Facebook from tracking you when you leave their site. And I don't think people are aware of these things, and I think they need to research a little more so they can take some more responsibility for what they have for data out there. And I'm not saying it's everyone's fault, but I definitely think people don't want to take the time to research some of this. And I'll admit, I'm one of the people that click on accept on a lot of things, and I don't read that whole legal thing for an hour. But I just think people need to spend some time on that. And I also think that Facebook should be held accountable for its so-called mistakes, because there's no way someone can own a company that long and not understand it and understand how it works.
Jennifer, thanks so much for the call. Two great points, one about personal responsibility and what Facebook had to have known. Let's go to one more call. Braxton is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Braxton, you're on the air, and it's good to have you.
Yes, I'm just calling. I'm 21 years old, and I was just – a lot of my peers, I guess, don't quite take as much interest in this as it seems like the people who are questioning – who the different government agencies who are questioning all the tactics that Facebook's using right now. And
I also feel like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is part of that sort of generation, and the creation of Facebook and his ideas behind it and all that are, you know, he has such an idea of what Facebook is to him that he did sort of get caught up and, you know, overlook the what it's morphed into. And I feel like a lot of, you know, the generation that grew up with Facebook is also in that, you know, same mindset.
Braxton, thanks so much for that call. We're going to take up that point. Dipayan, I'd love to get your response to Braxton. This idea that we're dealing with, a company that was founded by a generation that really sort of couldn't see beyond this corner, what was coming.
Yeah, I think that's true to an extent.
Yeah.
Mark Zuckerberg is absolutely responsible, more responsible for the missteps of this company than anyone else. As are people like Sundar Pichai and Larry Page for the missteps of their companies. But what I would say is that it's his responsibility. He has a board that oversees his work. He has surrounded himself with senior officials and advisors who are very bright and who are some of them from a let's say an older generation, more wizened. Particularly on policy and legal affairs, and in many cases, the company should have known better.
Do you still believe, and this sort of gets back to the big question I asked you at the end of the last break, the potential of this technology to still be a democratic and liberating force in our society? Because it was, you know, just 10 years ago, that's the way it was being talked about. Barack Obama used it in this incredible way to sort of bring people together and redefine the way elections were run. Now we're talking about a much darker set of forces that it seems to have unleashed.
I think implicitly that power still exists. Looking back as another example to 2011 with the Arab Spring,
right.
this was a platform alongside Twitter and other platforms that enabled voices to come together for the first time in places like Egypt. Millions and millions of people coming together on platforms like Facebook to talk about the troubles that they faced in their daily lives and essentially revolt, have a digital revolution against oppression in their local situation. And that implicit power of that technology still exists. Since then, the company introduced a lot of advertising technology, particularly in 2012, 2013, which has created a commercial regime that sits behind Facebook and other internet companies that allows any nefarious actor or legitimate advertiser to get into it and start doing things that are against the public's interest, from disinformation to hate speech. So I think that implicit power still exists, but there are a lot of problems that really need to be corrected as soon as possible.
Shira Frankel, time is running out, but in the 20 seconds that remains, do you believe still, or are you at all optimistic in that implicit power as a force for good?
Well, I wanted to note something that Dipayan said about Mark surrounding himself with advisors and a board, obviously. He's still chief executive and chairman of the company, and people, you know, may forget this, but he has 60% of the shares in the company. So he can surround himself with all the advisors in the world, but at the end of the day, they're just giving advice. There's no one who has power over him. There's no one who can force him to make a change or force him to sort of take a step back and really ask himself if he's taking the right steps. And I think that inherent power structure is part of what's really damaging in that company.
Interesting. Shira Frankel, cybersecurity reporter for the New York Times. Thank you so much for your reporting. Thanks for joining us today. We're really grateful.
Thank you.
And Dipayan Ghosh, fellow at Harvard Kennedy School and former privacy and public policy advisor at Facebook. Thanks so much for coming in, Dipayan. It was great having you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And listeners, this conversation continues at onpointradio.org. You can continue to join the conversation. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.